Numbers, Pape 5, Chapter 5.
Yes, we're all sinners. Yes, we fall short of thee. But only you can speak. To speak to our hearts now as we look into thy word. We still don't know what you want to know from you. We can give a lot of facts. I'm not able to expect. The work of principle is one of the things.
Why don't we get the basic message of Numbers before you? Numbers is divided into three sections, before the march, during the march, and after the march. That's a simple way to remember it. The first 10 chapters we just illustrated with the plus sign. These were the last 3 weeks, through verse 10 of chapter 10, the last 3 weeks at Mount Sinai. That was definitely God's will. And then 11 through 20 is the minus sign. That was not God's will. That's the years of wandering in the wilderness. And then the last chapters are sort of a blending together of God's will and man's will. Now, the two words that are used over and over again in Numbers are the word journey and the word wilderness. Something over 50 or 60 times. And so we say the message is the journey through the wilderness. And for years, that's how I looked at Numbers. In Hebrews chapter 3, it says this, I was angry with them for 40 years because they did not see my ways. You see, the message of Numbers, when you say wilderness, in the context of Numbers, it's not the pilgrim life, the wilderness through life. It's a land of disobedience. And it's the land of broken fellowship. And it's not God's plan that they wander in the wilderness. And so the message is, you say it's the journey through the wilderness. That's one side of it. But the other side is this. Are you seeing men walk through the wilderness? When you read Numbers, you don't see men. What you see instead is God. You see the manna. You see the quail. And you see the rock. And you see their feet supernaturally preserved from swelling. And their clothes from rotting off their bodies. And you see God preserving and leading and guiding, and the Shekinah glory cloud. It's not the journey of men. It's the journey of God. It's the will of God. And oh, what a tremendous book it is. Not very many books will give you what Numbers give you. What can I expect from God in the land of disobedience? What can I expect from God? How will He deal with me when I'm rebellious, when I'm hard, when I'm callous? And oh, you get the ways of God illustrated in the book of Numbers. We've used Exodus 33:13 because we want to be so cautious. I don't want you to see the journey through the wilderness. I want you to see the ways of God. But I don't even want you to see the ways of God. You see, Exodus 33:13 says, let me know thy ways that I might know thee. And the whole message of Numbers is how to know God by seeing His ways. The ways of God among the ways of men. It's God's journey through the wilderness. God was in a tent among a people in tents. And God dwelt in a tent through the wilderness. And it's just seeing the ways of God. The song we've chosen to illustrate it is Come Thou Fount. Listen to the words of this verse. Oh, the grace, how great a debtor. Daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness like a fetter bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. And that's a message of number. Now, when we left off last time, we were in the process of discussing these first 10 chapters. The last 3 weeks, 21 days, at the foot of Mount Sinai, where God gave Moses the law. We had done the first 4 chapters, or gone through it a little bit. The numbering and the organization of the people in chapters 1 and 2. The numbering and the organization of the Levites in chapters 3 and 4. That brings us to chapter 5. So if you'll turn to Numbers chapter 5, please. And we'll begin here tonight. Numbers chapter 5 we'll call the laws of physical and spiritual cleansing. the laws of physical and spiritual cleansing. Now, before we discuss this chapter in any details, and especially before we get into some of the principles of how God is revealed, let me just get the facts before you. There's three main divisions in chapter 5, and they all begin the same way. Chapter 5, verse 1 says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses." And after he finished saying something, verse 5 says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses." Then he said something else, and when he finished that, in verse 11, it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses." You see, it's well divided. You're able to see the division. God had three things to say in chapter 5. So we'll just outline it according to those verses. Chapter 5, 1 through 4, on the first message. Chapter 5, 5 through 11, on the second message, or rather 10. And then chapter 6, or 5, 6 through, wait a minute, 31 I believe it is, forms the third message. Now, let me just give you some titles for these sections, and there's going to be some overlapping, but let me just get it before you. If you notice chapter 5, 1 through 4, the thing that you'll notice is this. It deals with the group, Israel as a whole. And it's talking about the purity of the group. Then, if you notice 5 through 10, it's not talking about the group anymore. Now it's talking about the individual and restitution, confession and restitution that must be made within the individual. And then the last section is really tremendous because it's not even, it's talking about the individual, but here's what it's saying. If there's even the suspicion of sin, here's how to deal with it. And so if we just use three concentric circles, I think you'll get chapter 5. Group purity, individual purity, and then even the suspicion of sin needs to be dealt with. And that's how the chapter ends, under what we call the law of jealousy. And we'll try to develop that and explain that law to you in a moment. By having the basic bird's eye view of chapter 5 before you, let's ask the most important question we can ask. What is the wonderful revelation of Christ Himself that's given in chapter 5? See, we're going to ask this with every chapter in the book of Numbers in order that you might be Christ-centered rather than Bible-centered. The great revelation of Christ has to do with His holiness. And I just like to call it the imminence of the Holy God. Now remember what we explained once before. If you spell imminence with an A in the middle, it's not the same as if you put an I in the middle. I-M-M-A-N means abiding presence. See, the A stands for abiding. Close at hand, that God is near, so near that He indwells. You spell it with an I just use the I with the association of immediate. We speak of the imminent return of Christ. The immediate return of Christ, close at hand, is coming is close at hand. And so we're talking about imminence with the A, the imminence of the Holy God. Our Father who art in my heart, hallowed be thy name. Not the God that's far off in heaven who's holy, but the God who's close by who's holy. See, that's what this chapter is talking about. Now, we're going to call the first four verses the symbolic revelation of the holiness of God. And then we're going to call the next section the restitutional revelation of the holiness of God. And then we're going to call the last section the miraculous revelation of the holiness of God. See, God gives the symbolic, first of all. Notice verse 2, send away. Verse 3, send away. Send them out of the camp. Verse 4, send them outside the camp. Then you move to the restitutional revelation. In other words, when you make restitution, you weren't only supposed to pay back what you'd stolen. But according to this section, you'd have to pay it back with interest. In other words, you had to give back the original amount plus one-fifth more. See, here's the great acid test on whether or not you really gripped the holiness of God. And whether the holiness of God has really gripped you. You see, if you really have come in to the imminence of the holy God, God's in your midst, you'll be willing to make restitution. And if you're not willing to make restitution, then you haven't learned the message of Numbers chapter 5. And then the last verses, 11 through 31, the miraculous revelation. Now, before we discuss these different aspects of holiness, let me give you what I consider to be the key to this chapter. The key to this chapter is in chapter 5, the last verse, the last phrase of verse 3. The last phrase of verse 3, the last five words, I dwell in their midst. You see why we call this the imminence of the Holy God? Why is he talking about group purity? And why is he talking about individual purity? And why is he talking about dealing with even the suspicion of sin? The suspicion of immorality? The answer is, I dwell in their midst. The Holy God lives in the midst of us. Therefore, there is the appeal for purity. Because God is in the midst. Now notice, holiness is not the goal. Sometimes we have the idea, well, we've got to be holy in the group in order to maintain our orthodoxy. Got to have pure doctrine, you know. The goal is not pure doctrine. The goal is not orthodoxy. Someone says, well, we've got to be holy in order to keep a good testimony, in order to keep a good reputation, in order that we might hold our respectability before the eyes of men. That's true, but that's not the goal. That's not why you're supposed to be holy. That isn't why God appeals to the group to be holy, or the individual. Someone says, well, we're after holiness and sanctification. No, not as an abstract thing. That isn't how the Bible presents it. Why are we to be holy? And the answer is the Holy One is in our midst. That's why we're to be holy. Because God himself is not transcendent. He's imminent. He's close by. He's not far off. The Holy God is in our midst. And all when we hunger after holiness, what we're really saying is, I want fellowship with the Holy God. God's in the group, and God's in my heart. And therefore, even his frown must cause me to deal with sin. The Holy One. You see, God's light. And in him there's no darkness at all. And it's he, the person, the Holy One himself, that's in our midst. Pure doctrine and a clean conscience, forgiveness of sin and a good testimony, and sanctification, they're sort of incidental. They're sort of byproducts to this main thing. Be holy because I am holy. Because I'm in your midst. And there's the great appeal of holiness. You see, this is so basic, and yet so many just seem to pass by it. For example, many preach forgiveness of sins as if that were the goal. It's a great appeal. Right now, today, you can be clean. Your heart can be washed. I don't care how ingrained the sin. Though your sins are scarlet, indelibly dyed upon your soul, you can be clean. Not anybody wants that. Let's bow and pray. And they say, in there. The Bible doesn't end there. Forgiveness is not a goal. Forgiveness is the starting point. You see, the message of the gospel is this. The Holy God can't live in a dirty heart. Why do you get forgiveness? In order for God to move in. That's the whole point. That's the whole message of forgiveness. Forgiveness is just cleaning out the dump. It's getting the rubbish out of the way. It's clearing the deck. It's cleaning the house. Forgiveness is wonderful, but it's only the preparation. And the whole message of Numbers and the message of the Bible is this. God is in our midst. Why do I get forgiven? In order that God might come in. God must live in a clean house. God must live in a clean heart. And when you're dealing with a group, God says, I want a holy group because I dwell in the midst. And when I deal with a family, I want a holy family because I dwell in the midst. And when I deal with an individual, I want a holy person because I dwell in the midst. You see how that's the key? But you don't understand Numbers 5 apart from that. It's God in the midst. The Holy One wants fellowship with the group, wants fellowship with the individual, and he can't tolerate group sin or individual sin or even the slightest suspicion of sin in your heart because he lives there. See, there's the great appeal. And apart from that, you're not going to understand Numbers 5. Numbers 5 is just, I dwell in your midst. I forgot where this reference is, and I didn't plan to say it, but holiness becometh thy house. Remember that reference? It must be in the Psalm. I forgot where it is. But oh, that's a tremendous verse. Holiness becometh thy house. All right, any comments or questions about that approach? All right, with that in mind, let's try to develop these sections and see how God develops it. We may ask this question. Since the key is that the Holy One is in the midst, each one of these sections is designed to prove whether or not you've come to grips with that. You see, it's the acid test. And each one of these is a reality test as to whether or not I've really been laying hold of the message that the Holy One is in my midst. It's quite easy to say, you know, that God's in our midst. It's quite another thing to believe it in reality. And God doesn't leave us on our own. He gives us tests so that we might know whether or not we really have believed it. And so these are three sections of chapter 5, but that's sort of incidental. Three tests as to whether or not you really believe the Holy God is in your midst. The first one is in verses 5, 1 through 4. We'll call it the separation test. The separation test. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper, and everyone having a discharge, and everyone who's unclean because of a dead person. You shall send away both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so that they will not defile the camp where I dwell in the midst. The sons of Israel did so and sent them outside the camp, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses, thus the sons of Israel did. You see, this illustration had to do with Israel as a whole, and the purging of that which was unclean from the group, from the camp. In the New Testament, we talk about church discipline. The place where the Holy One dwells must be clean. Church discipline is a great truth of God. It's a neglected truth, but it's a great truth. Separation from evil. When a person, an individual, lives a slipshod, reckless life. Sometimes he's called antinomian. Are you familiar with that phrase? One reason I'm giving it is because you'll probably be seeing it or reading it, and you ought to be familiar with it. Antinomian, the word in the Greek, nomos, means law, anti, against the law. And a lot of people, in the name of pure grace, are antinomian. The whole idea is look to Jesus and live any old way you want to live. And as long as you're looking to Christ, you don't have to obey, and you don't have to do this and that. You don't have to be separate. The Bible doesn't teach that. But many who hold or claim to hold pure grace are antinomian. Well, this section, the appeal of these first four verses, is against corporate antinomianism. It's possible on an individual level, but it's also possible with a group. That a group will tolerate sin in the camp. And oh, what a deadly thing it is. And God says, I dwell in the group. No matter what group it is, where it's God's people, I'm in the midst. And therefore, purge out the old leaven. You're familiar with 1 Corinthians 5, 7? But 1 Corinthians 5 is a great chapter in the New Testament on separation. But 1 Corinthians 5, 7, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump. I generally jot down a reference to save a little time, but I'm going to ask you to turn to this one in order that you might see the pronoun. I'm going to ask you to turn to Joshua chapter 7. You can almost guess what I'm going to use here. I believe this is the greatest single illustration in the Bible of the danger of having leaven in the group. Can you guess what it is? Aiken in the camp is right. I'll be right with you as soon as I find my way. I feel like I just went to a new town with this Bible. I just can't find my way around it. It's a new Bible, and I'm having all kinds of trouble. Lillian should break it in before she gives me a new Bible. Chapter 7, verse 11, please. Now, are you familiar with the facts of the story of Achan in the camp? I presume you are. Now, with that in mind, listen to this. Verse 11. Israel has fallen. They have transgressed my covenant which I commanded them. They have even taken some of the things under the ban, have both stolen and deceived. They have put them among their own things. You say, well, wait a minute now. There were hundreds of thousands of Israelites didn't even know what was going on. And now God says, they have stolen, they have taken, they have transgressed, they have hidden. What right does God have to include me in that sin? Verse 12. Therefore the sons of Israel, all of them, cannot stand before their enemies. They turn their backs before their enemies, for they have become a curse. Now watch, here's the appeal of Numbers 5. I will not be with you anymore unless you destroy the thing under the ban from your midst. It's the presence of God that's important. And God says, purge out the leaven that you might be a new lump, or I won't be with you anymore. Of course, the great principle there is that every time any member of the body sins, the whole body is affected. Nobody sins privately. It affects the whole body, the church. And then Joshua 7:12 says, I'll not be with you anymore unless you destroy those things under the ban. You see, it's not the attitude, oh, we must judge certain people and kick them out like Numbers 5, 1 through 4 says, and then have a holier-than-thou attitude. See, that's what they accuse us of, having a holier-than-thou attitude. That isn't the point. It isn't that you have a holier-than-thou attitude. The attitude is the holy ones in our midst, and we must deal with this. Oh, that's a big difference. Not the holier-than-thou, but the holy one in our midst. And if people would really grip that, then the appeal would be, listen, we love you, brother, we love you, sister, but the fellowship of the Holy One is more important than hurting your feelings or not hurting them. And to deal with the cursed thing, some would say, well, we don't want to be divisive, you know, and cause a schism, and we don't want to hurt anyone's feelings and set ourselves up as judges. Do you realize what this chapter is saying in Numbers? The higher your view of the holiness of God, the more you're going to deal with sin and guilt. The higher my view of the holiness of God, the more I'm going to deal with sin and guilt. You realize when churches or assemblies or any group is weak on discipline, they're weak on the view of the holiness of God. See, that's what it's saying. And you don't need to brush up on discipline. No church needs to brush up on discipline. They need a new vision of the Holy One in their midst. And then automatically, sin is going to be dealt with in the group. And to tolerate sin in the group is to have a low view, a weak view of God's holiness. And also, I believe, it shows little real concern for intimate fellowship with the Holy One in our midst. Of course, the truth is that God's plan is church discipline. And it will never separate church. It cannot. Now, it might separate an association that claims to be a church. But God's body can't be separated. And so it will never really hurt. It will only hurt those antagonistic bodies who are opposed to it anyway. But the real body will never be injured by going in God's way. And then chapter 5, 5 through 10, the second test of holiness is the restitution test. See, these verses repeat the trespass offering of Leviticus chapter 5. Goes through all that and reveals it again. Now, chapter 5, verse 7, he shall confess his sin which he's committed. According to Numbers 5, 7, you find that confession is not enough. Confession is not enough. He said, oh, I must also go and tell the person I'm sorry if I've offended them or if I've stolen something. No, if you read chapter 7 carefully, verse 7 carefully, you'll find out that saying you're sorry is not enough. That is enough. He's talking here about restitution. he shall confess his sins which he's committed and make restitution in full for his wrong and add the one-fifth of it. In other words, you pay back with interest. One-fifth more than you ever stole from the individual. And God says, there is the check if you're really believing God's in your midst. You're going to want to be right with God if he's in your midst. And you're also going to want to be right with man. Now, the only reason I'm laying any emphasis on this at all is because in the name of pure grace, there's a lot of easygoing believism. And I know I'm not called to be a defender of pure grace. God's grace doesn't need defending. Most of all, it doesn't need it by me. But oh, it just grieves my heart. Honestly, sometimes it feels like my heart's going to be wrenched out. When I see the attitude that's light, flippant, careless, slipshod, nonchalant, where sin is regarded as a light thing, and all this trifling with iniquity, and I say, I'm looking to Jesus. Oh, that just grieves my heart. And I know it must grieve the Lord, and for sure, it doesn't deal with the moral roots of sin. It doesn't get down deep. And the applications of this are unlimited, but what God is saying is this. Is God really in your midst? Then if you've sinned against a brother, go make it. Go make it. Don't just say, oh, I'm looking to God, and he's forgiven me, and everything's all right. You're not really right with God if you're not willing to be right with men. And what God is saying here is, here's the test if you really believe the Holy One's in your midst. It's a restitution test. See, it's so easy to spout off a doctrine saying, I believe in the imminence of the Holy God. See, that's easy to say. God says, really? Let's check. Do you deal with sin in the group? See, if you don't really believe that doctrine. You say, oh, that's easy to say. I believe in the imminence of the Holy God. Are you willing to make restitution against those you've sinned against? I'm not saying that's going to be easy. And sometimes it's impossible to do. And the applications get thornier and thornier. Sometimes you can't remember who you sinned against. And sometimes so many years have gone under the bridge, you're not exactly sure even where they are or how to contact them. Sometimes it might be more harm done by bringing up some old snake than letting it lay dead, you know. And I know this for sure. I don't have all the answers to all the applications, but I know the principle. And I know this for sure, that God will guide you. See, the principle is be real. That's the idea. Make your relationship with God real. And one side is that you're willing to be right with men. But reality is the goal there, and be real. Now, of course, you realize that we're dealing with deceitful hearts. And at any moment, I can make restitution tenfold and not be real in the heart. But it isn't the restitution. That isn't what God does. The principle is be real, and God's testing the reality of this thing. And it's easy to act in spiritual pride on this thing. But confession and restitution, if you're real, if you believe that God is there, then you ought to do that. Now, let me just qualify a little bit. Restitution, confession too. You know, confession to man when you confess your faults one to another. Confession to man and restitution must be made within the circle of the sin. You don't go to some strange group of believers and get up and say, I sinned against Aunt Clarence and Uncle Mabel or whatever. You don't do it that way, see? In other words, it's none of their business. You don't go confessing your sins to anyone. Only within the circle of your sin. As far as your sin is gone, there you make your restitution.
Thank you.
Apostle would say, but there may be some dire consequences. If I go to someone and say, hey, I stole your horse, and they thought it ran away or something, you know, and I did all this my pre-salvation day, and if you have to turn in your pre-salvation credit card, the siphon hose where you used to get your gas and all, you know. I know this, that you can leave that with the Lord, and He will give you the grace to go up and face that person or that group of people. In my own case, when I had to get right with God, it involved hundreds of people that I had to get right with. And God gives the grace to do it, and the wisdom to know when to do it, and how to put it across. You got to trust God for that. But if you're willing to be right with God, and if you really believe with a burning passion, holy one, okay, living in my heart, you're going to want to be right with God. You're going to want to be right with man. And willingness to make it right with men is the test as to whether or not it's really in your heart. And boy, if you really treasure God's fellowship, then restitution is a very little thing. And of course, God will give you the grace to do it. So if you really treasure the Holy One, and you're going to purge out the group, and you're going to make restitution as God guides you. I'm not going to give you a bunch of rules on what to say and how to say it. No, God will guide you as to the details. And I suppose there'll be times when He'll say, it better let that thing lay dead. I don't know how God will guide you. But the point is, be real. And then you grip the holiness of God. And then the third test, we call the miraculous test. It's the miraculous revelation of the holiness of God. You notice in verses 11 through 31, there's a strange law that's mentioned. It's called the law of jealousy. This law didn't have to do with the act of sin. It had to do with the suspicion of sin. I'll let you read it on your own. I'll just sort of tell you the facts about it. A husband had a suspicion about his wife that she was unfaithful. He didn't have any proof. She wasn't caught in any act, wasn't caught doing anything. But he just had the idea that she was unfaithful to him. Now, there was a special aspect of Jewish life that this law of jealousy, as it's called, was designed to purify. The law of jealousy was designed to purify the home life of the children of Israel. You've heard the old adage, keep the home fires burning. Well, Numbers 5 says, keep the home fires burning as far as purity and love are concerned. See, that's the great emphasis here. Now, here's the law of jealousy. Very unusual. A woman was accused, whether rightly or wrongly, but accused of being unfaithful to her husband. So her husband took her by the arm and brought her to the priest. And the husband said to the priest, I have an idea. She's been unfaithful. She's been untrue. She's broken her fidelity with me. And I want you to test it. So then the priest would give her what's called in this chapter the water of bitterness. Say, well, what's the water of bitterness? It's just water with some dust in it. That's all it is. He would reach down, take some dust from the ground, put it in the water. Now, if she were falsely accused, that is, if she were innocent, then she'd have to drink this water of bitterness, and nothing would happen to her, even though it was dirty water. She just, hepatitis maybe, but nothing would happen to her, alright? If she was wrongly accused, or rather rightly accused, that is, if she were unfaithful, an amazing thing would happen when she drank the water. Her thigh would begin to waste away, and then her whole body would become unduly swollen. And the point is here, the fact is, that it was a mighty miracle of God. That God actually gave the priest the power to work this miracle in order to preserve the home life, the purity of the home life of the children of Israel. Now when we think of miracle workers in the Old Testament, you don't generally think of priests, do you? Think about the prophets. Elijah and Elisha and that kind of thing. Oh, they were mighty men of miracles. Yeah, that's true, but so were the priests. This isn't the only illustration. of the miracles of the priests. Matter of fact, they had one quite often. You remember which one they had almost every day? The evening sacrifice. God lit the evening sacrifice with lightning from heaven. Isn't that an amazing thing? God did it. And that's what was wrong with Nadab and Abihu when they offered strange fire. See, the fire didn't fall down from heaven, so they lit their own fire. It was a natural fire. All natural fire deserves the judgment of God. And all four people that would wait for the fire from God, see, before they'd light the fire. But these priests were a miracle. And let me give the great principle that I see in this section, and then try to drive it home. The principle is this. God is waiting to work a special miracle in my heart, in your heart, to reveal sin in my life. It takes a miracle of God to detect sin. See, that's a great principle there. In other words, how do you know if you're guilty? Sometimes, you know, you just sort of feel guilty. The devil loves to nag God's children, throw dust in their eyes, and try to make them just all the time squirm, and just sort of feel rotten, feel filthy and vile. And sometimes they ought to be living in the liberty of the Lord with a clear conscience. And they shouldn't be going around feeling morbid and feeling guilty. But the devil loves to torture God's children that way. And the principle is this, that God will work a miracle in order to show you whether you're guilty. He's promised to do that. Now, there's a great movement in the world today, which you're all familiar with. It's the psychological movement. And the people of God have been badly burned. Badly burned. And the one who talks to you right now has been badly burned. See, we've been breathing the air of this thing so long, we hardly know that it's poison. Because it is every day, every place you turn, the Christian magazines you pick up, the books you read on Christian stations, in Bible schools and churches, the whole movement has been psychology. You know that whole approach here, self-awareness and self-discovery, and try to find out those deep, hidden, inner thoughts. And if you've had some blocks that they've hindered you along the way, let's discuss them. Find out what they are. Remove them so that you're able to go on and all that kind of thing. Set free your inner feelings. Dig down deep inside and find your motive and all that kind of thing. Well, I'm so glad the Bible never tells you to do that. I'm so glad God never tells you to do that. Because you realize why, don't you? You've got a deceitful heart. And your heart would never tell the truth about yourself. It would lie its head off. You look down inside and say, now what am I like? Mirror, mirror on the wall, you know. And that's the only kind of answer you can expect from your heart. Your heart's a liar, and so is mine. So what do you expect from a liar? And the heart is deceitful above all things. You can't discover your own heart. Here's God's method. Psalm 139, 23 and 24. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. See, that's how God does it. God does the searching. God will work a miracle in your life to show you whether you're guilty. You don't have to go looking in your heart and self-analysis and all that kind of foolishness. Not at all. You look away to Jesus. Now, God wants you to have a tender conscience. Don't get me wrong. He wants you to have a tender conscience, a sensitive conscience, a responsive conscience, but not a scrupulous conscience, not a morbid conscience, not a conscience that's governed by fear and anxiety, but a conscience that's governed by the revealed word and by the Spirit of God. And He's the one that'll search you. He'll show you when you've sinned. He'll put His finger on it. If you really believe that the Holy One's in your midst, you'll be willing to deal with your sin. If you really believe the Holy One's in your midst, you'll be willing to make restitution when you've sinned against men. If you really believe the Holy One is in your midst, you'll trust Him day by day to work the miracle of the detection of sin. You let Him search you. And the Hebrew is very strong. Doesn't say, search me, O God. The Hebrew says, dig deep, O God, and know my heart. Isn't that tremendous? The deep diggings of God in my soul. Are you willing to let God put His spade in your heart? Dig deep, O God. Search me with a spotlight. Know my soul. See if there be any wicked way in me. trust God to work that miracle in your heart. So number five gives three tests, three reality tests that the Holy One is in your midst. The church discipline test, the confession restitution test, and then trusting God for the miracle to show you any trace of sin, even the suspicion of sin. To the degree you pass those tests, to that same degree, His holy presence has begun to make a difference in your life. His holy presence has begun to make a difference in my life. Well, let's begin chapter 6. Let me just get it before you, and then we'll continue it next time. Numbers chapter 6. Let me give you a simple outline once again. There's two big sections, chapter 1 through 21, or rather verses 1 through 21, and then 22 through 27, just a short little thing. We call 1 through 21 the law of the Nazarite. And then we call 22 through 27 the high priestly benediction, the most famous of all benedictions in the Bible, the high priestly benediction. All right, let's look at the first 21 verses. Let me get some facts before you and then quickly leave them so we can get into the juicy part. The juicy part has to do with knowing the law. Alright, what is a Nazarite? Now notice, it says Nazarite, not Nazarene. It's so easy to confuse those two words. See, according to Matthew 2:23, Jesus was a Nazarene, not a Nazarite. That simply means that Jesus was someone from Nazareth, of Galilee. And the whole idea was, because he was from Nazareth, it was a despised place, and he became a hated and despised person. And the prophet said, he shall be a Nazarene. But did you ever notice, it doesn't say which prophet? New Testament says, sometimes it says, as Isaiah says, or as Jeremiah says. This time it says, the prophets said, he shall be called a Nazarene. Then you look in the Bible and say, I never see that. Where's that prophecy quoted from? Not one time does it say he shall be called a Nazarene. And the New Testament, Matthew not only gives the quote, but it also gives all the prophets credit for saying it. So then the prophets said he shall be called a Nazarene. Well, the answer is simple. What was a Nazarene? A Nazarene was a hated, was a despised person. That's the message of all the prophets. All the prophets said he shall be called a Nazarene. He'll be a hated and despised person. But a Nazarite that we're dealing with here in chapter 6, he's a separated person, one that's consecrated. You see, in the history of redemption, he had this place. God used the Nazarite in order to keep the truth of separation as an object lesson before the eyes of the people of God. Every place they turned around, they saw Nazarite in order that God might keep his message before their eyes. Someone would ask this question. Were all the Israelites called to be literal Nazarites? Were they all called to take literal vows of separation? The answer is no, they weren't. Only a handful were called to be literal Nazarites. Otherwise, were all the Israelites called to be heart Nazarites? The answer is yes, they were. They were all called to be separated people. And God just used the literal Nazarite to keep the truth of separation before the minds of the people. And so this one class of people publicly lived the law of separation as an object lesson reminder to keep that truth before them. One of the great movements of the church today is an anti-separationist movement. You know, the whole idea that we don't want all this separation and this whole movement against separation. Now, most of these anti-separationist movements capitalize on the abuses of separation. And we ought to run from the abuses of separation. But when you run from an abuse of the truth, be real careful that you don't run from the truth itself. God hasn't called us to run from separation. He's called us to run from the abuses of it. But I don't want to run from separation. We need this Nazarite chapter today almost more than they needed it in Old Testament days. The truth of separation is really taking a beating among God's people today. It really is. And we really need to stress this. Don't make the mistake that many have made by saying the Nazarite was a monk, or the Nazarite was a hermit. He wasn't a monk in a monastery. He wasn't a hermit. Here's one reason I know that. A hermit is someone that lives off by himself alone. See, the whole idea of the monastery, I've been doing a little studying on these mystics, these ancient mystics. Well, they'd seclude themselves in a monastery and lock themselves up from the world and draw a little circle and isolate themselves in the circle. The Nazarite didn't do that. The Nazarite lived among the people publicly. He didn't live in any shell. He didn't live in any monastery. He walked with God day by day before the people, right out in public. You turn around, you find a Nazarite. You could stop and talk to him on the street. See, God hadn't called you to be a monk. He hadn't called you to be a hermit. He's called all of us to be hardened Nazarites. Of course, you might be accused of being a monk. You might be accused of being a hermit if you are a true heart Nazarite. But the word here is the heart Nazarite. I love to relate this to Genesis 17. You know what Genesis 17 is about? Circumcision. See, circumcision was the, remember, the male was to be circumcised on the eighth day. And God called that the sign of separation. See, the main difference between the Nazarite and circumcision, one is a private separation, and the other is a public separation. God didn't give the law to Nazarite first. You see, you can't be publicly separated until first you're privately separated before God. And I just love to relate those two chapters together. Now, before I leave this and I'm ready to close, I want to give the chief emphasis of separation, and then we can build on that next time. Nine times in chapter 6, you find the same emphasis. In verse 2, it says, to the Lord. Verse 5, to the Lord. Verse 6, to the Lord. Verse 7, separation to God. And the same thing's true in verse 12, and 14, and 16, and 20, and 21. Nine times you have the same phrase, to the Lord. You see the basic emphasis of separation? Someone would say, be separate. What they mean by that is, separate from. Well, there is a separation from, but that's not the basic truth of separation. God's emphasis is separation unto. Separation unto the Lord. And then separation from follows on the heel of that. There's no such thing as separation from, apart from a separation unto. The starting point is unto the Lord. Are you familiar with 1 Thessalonians 1:9? You turn to God from idols. What came first? You turn to God, and then from idols. And if you really have separation unto, you're going to have separation from. Many would tell you to be separated unto the Lord and don't worry about anything else. See, that's not the full message. And the full message takes you to separation from as well. Our brother Falcon at the church, he calls, you know, these separation lists, he calls it your favorite list. He doesn't tell you what's in it. But he said, you all have your favorite list. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 and all. Those who preach separation from, and then they give you their special list, are under the law, not under grace. That's not the message. You see, it's separated under the Lord, and then from is a proof that we're separated unto. You realize you could be separated from a whole bunch of things, never be separated unto the Lord. And that's why God gave that great emphasis. I remember one time I was rebuked for wearing a tie pin, because someone told me I was worldly, and I was all wrapped up in the world because I wore a tie pin. And strange thing was, I hardly ever wore one. The one day I wore it, I got bitten, you know. They make a list of certain criteria in order to be spiritual. Here's the most famous list. No card playing, no picture shows, no smoking, no dancing, no mixed swimming, no games with the casting of dice, no long hair, no short skirts, and the list goes on and on. Now let me ask you this question. Is a person spiritual by refraining from those things? And the answer is no. Not at all. Those things do not help you one iota to be spiritual. Refrain from those things. What's the source of spirituality? Separation unto the Lord. See, unto the Lord. Now, if you're separated unto the Lord, will you be separated from some or all of those things? Probably so. Probably so. You see, but rather than saying separation from, you can have the from without the unto. And unto is the foundation. And that's why God emphasizes this in the law of the Nazarite. Now, I'm not quibbling about terms. This is a matter of truth for all. It's a different direction. It's not the same thing with different language. It's a different thing altogether. And rather than picking and nagging on all certain rules and don't do this and then, if you refrain from all that, you're supposed to be a spiritual outsider. That isn't the message of the Bible. You're related to the living God in a vital relationship. When you, as His spouse, embrace the bridegroom of your soul and culturate that relationship, then and only then, when you're separated unto Him. A brother-in-law told me one time, he says, you know, after I married your sister, I had no trouble giving up my girlfriend. A good thing. But you see the point? When he was related to her, those other things just fell away. You want to see things fall off your life, you get to know Jesus. That's why I want to preach that. I'm just going to preach, know the Lord, know the Lord. Be separated unto the Lord, be related to Him. And then I'm going to sit back and watch these things fall off your life. Oh, it's tremendous. And it's God's emphasis. Well, we'll pick it up in a minute. Comments or questions? Correction. Let's pray. Our Father, we do thank Thee that the Holy One is in our midst. Check the reality of that in our lives. Give us the grace to be pure as a corporate body. Give us the grace to be pure as individuals. Cause us to trust Thee to work a miracle to show us where we're guilty. Thank You, Lord, that You're going to do that for us. And I pray that everyone here, those in person tonight and those following this group of studies by faith, by Your grace, make us hardened Nazarites, separated unto the Lord. In Jesus' name we come.